Hello and welcome to The Price of Music, the show that looks at the money behind the music industry with me, Steve Lamack, and Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge. How's things with you, Stuart?
I'm good. Do you know, I've rediscovered the joys of walking, long walks with albums on and listening to full albums.
Oh, right, okay. And do you have a particular, do you have a different walk for a different mood of music, different style of music?
I'm sort of figuring it out. I went for the other day and I got through the Hooray for the Riff Raff album three times in a row, like back to back. And it just, It reminded me of being a teenager when you'd listen to albums and stick them straight on again. You know, it doesn't happen nowadays. So yeah, I'm sort of, I'm getting back into long form listening, just going against every trend that I write about ever.
I might give that a go. I'm having a couple of days off on the Kent Riviera after this, which I'm looking forward to. You know, the stiff coastal breeze and some fish and chips. But yeah, I'll have to find some musical accompaniment for that. It will be very bracing. We have been sifting through some more of your questions for this episode. So we're going to dedicate this episode to some of your inquiries. Thank you very much to everyone who's been in touch. We'll start with this one. This is from Andy Aubrey, who says, my question is regarding physical album sales. If my local record shop, just a quick plug here for Just Dropped in Coventry, if my local record shop buys 10 copies of a new release from a supplier, are they automatically classed as 10 sales towards the album chart? Is that a daft question? Do they actually have to sell those 10 copies to 10 punters for them to count towards the album chart for that week? If so, does the record shop then, if they have to sell them individually to 10 people, does the record shop then have to report that they've sold X amount of copies and then contact the chart compilers to tell them how much they've sold? Because this seems, says Andy, this seems like an extremely laborious process if they have to write down and report every LP they sell from their stock. I'm sure you knew the answer to this anyway, Stuart, but you've done some research as well on top of this.
Yeah, I know people who know this. So thanks for this, for Lauren and Martin at the Official Charts Company. I'm particularly lucky for us that I asked them this question before Norwich beat Ipswich in the Old Farm Derby at the weekend. So Martin answered politely rather than telling me to get sling my
hook. Do I guess then that Martin at the Official Charts Company is an Ipswich Town fan?
He is, yes.
And you're a Norwich fan, right?
And rightfully so. He's very happy about how Ipswich are playing at the moment. So, you know, the underdogs. So but he answered before that, luckily. But they were very helpful because basically they said, yeah, it's not a daft question at all. But yeah, albums need to be bought by a consumer to count towards the chart. Right. So it's not about how many copies the shop gets in. It's about how many they sell. And if you buy it online, you have to buy it and they have to have been shipped. They have to have been sent to you. So you can't just sort of buy 10 copies and then you get sent one.
Right.
So back to the 1950s, Martin was saying that what's been delivered to a retailer isn't the sales, it's actual sales.
Right.
In terms of how it works, he was saying that it can be a bit laborious for independent shops depending on what systems they use, but it's fully electronic data delivery. So basically from their sales system to the charts collection, which is a company called Kantar, I think. And he was saying apparently in the old days, 1980s, they'd get rung up by someone from Gallup, who was the company that did the charts, and have to read the information out over the phone to them about what they'd sold. So, you know, it's definitely a lot less laborious.
That is true, isn't it? That's how the charts used to be compiled. Gallup, who for one point had the contract to collate all the sales, someone from Gallup would phone up all these record shops, you know, individually. They'd phone up a record shop and somebody at the record shop had to stand there and read out the amount of records they'd sold by each individual single and album, how many copies of that they'd sold in a week, which must have been, I mean, it's incredibly time consuming. And I think, you know, all the new tech, the chart shops would write down the catalogue number. I mean, I'm sure, I know we've got at least one person who worked at a record shop back in the day who listens to this, who might want to put us right. But I think you had to write down the catalogue number and then you'd have this massive list and then you'd either send the massive list off or somebody would phone you up to ask you what you'd sold during that week.
Yeah. So there's more than 8,000 apparently, stores reporting sales to Kantar now for the charts. And that's the all the big record shops and independent. I think the independent ones is like a sample of the ones that sell most music. And actually, Lauren from the OCC, she said, she reminded me about a thing called Lightning Live, which is album sales at gigs. So if you're the artist and you're selling albums at your gig, you can register for those to be chart eligible now. Mm.
You do have to let them know in advance, though, to do that, don't you? You can't just you can't put an album on sale at a gig, sell 30 albums, and then phone them up and say, "Can we be part of this scheme? Can we report these records?" You have to do it ahead of time, don't you?
Yeah, we sold 10,000 albums. Like, I want the receipts. I have lost them, but yeah. So so that's and she was saying that's about broadening out because people do buy albums at gigs and making sure that goes into the. The chart. So yeah, so it's kind of a system, but yeah, suffice to say, an album's got to be bought to get into the charts. It can't just be kind of shipped into a store and left out the back.
Yeah, and it's and just to stress, it's not every shop is a chart return shop, but an awful lot of them are. But I think some bands, you probably know some of the chart return shops by where bands go on those, you know, the tours that they do week of release. I'm sure those are mostly around independent shops who return their data to the official charts company.
One thing that would be good, I think, sometimes, I'm not sure this is a real episode or just in my head, but talking to some people about chart shenanigans in the past, like in the days when you could drive around the country buying, you know, I'd love to. I think nowadays it's obviously very carefully done, but I'm sure in the past there was some scope for shenanigans.
I mean, certainly right up to, certainly through the 70s and 80s, I think that was a thing, but even up to the 90s. And a way around this, and this is another reason, Andy, why it has to come down to the records being bought rather than the records that have got into the shop, because certainly a lot of the majors were doing deals on stock for record shops during the 90s. So if you bought two copies, you'd get another one free. In some cases, if they were really pushing, particularly new artists, they could do deals of anything up to buy two, get, you'll get five copies, you'll get three free, which was just a way of getting stock into the shops. But that's obviously, that's why you have to buy the records. It's not just down to how many records the distributor or the record label has managed to persuade you to take and rack out. I used to be, I mean, this is funny you should mention this, because there was, I remember back in the 80s, there was a TV program about chart fixing or chart hyping, as they called it. And one of my favorite bands, one of their records had been hyped into the chart very poorly, got to number 72. So it didn't always work. But I was obsessed by the singles charts when I was a kid. I'm not sure if you went through this phase, but for a few years, I used to listen to all the charts on a regular, particularly the Capital Countdown, which was the top 40 in London, which they used to unveil on a Saturday morning. And because it was just sales in London, I wasn't even living in London at the time, but you could just about pick up Capital Radio when it was good, where I lived out in Essex. And because it was just London sales, the chart was quite often ahead of the national chart, or would feature records which were slightly edgier or slightly more, in my teenage head, slightly cooler than the charts, than records in the national chart. But I was absolutely, I used to be obsessed by the charts. Happy days.
It was that appointment listening, wasn't it? The chart show. Because when I was growing up, and so I'm a little bit younger, but my childhood was smash hits and Top of the Pops. And so the chart was absolutely, and the chart show on radio. So it was like charts were the centerpiece of the week, weren't they? And
yeah,
in some ways, much. I guess. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much, Andy, and thanks to Lauren and Martin. I went to school with Martin Talbot. Did you know that?
No.
There you go. You seem very impressed. He was a couple of years younger than me. I think actually we might have actually been on the same football team for one match when we played for Halstead Town under somethings when his team were short of a goalkeeper. But thank you very much, Martin. Question two, Fraser Patterson poses this. Fraser says, a band who I like, the La Fontaines, have their own podcast as well as music on streaming services. Now, does the revenue created by streams for the podcast go into the same pot as the music streams, or do they go into separate, basically, streams of pay revenue? How does that work?
No, they're correct second time round. It's different. So podcasts don't get paid. In fact, there is no pot for podcasts on Spotify and services. They don't get paid per stream like music does. So on streaming services, like ones where like Spotify, where they have music and podcasts, you make money from your podcast either by having advertising in it, which you can put there yourself, or maybe the company you host it with, or you can charge subscriptions. So Apple and Spotify let you do podcast subscriptions. And in that case, you can say, right, pay £3 to get our podcast. But in both cases, yeah, it's completely separate to the music royalties pool. So if you're a band, you're not taking money away from other bands by doing a podcast. It's just another way of making money. But, and I think producer Guy has talked about this, about the level podcasts get to before they can start earning good money from ads. And I think he was saying it's 10,000 listeners, I think, before you can really. So as a band, if you're doing a podcast, you can't just start doing one and earn money. You have to build up your audience to kind of, quite a few thousand people. And then you might get those host read ads. And I don't know if the LaFontaines do any of that stuff. Are they advertising?
Do you know what? I had to listen because, well, I was intrigued by the question. And so I listened to one of the most recent episodes. I've got to say, it was pretty entertaining. It's just the members of the band sitting around chatting. But they were coming up with, one of them decided that the way to raise their profile was to find some, I quote, some beef with somebody. And they just sat there having a conversation about who they could start basically an argument with, either on social media or whatever. And it was very funny in places, although I will say it does include quite a lot of colourful language. So don't play it in front of juniors. I would say, but it did make me think, some bands are great guests on the radio. They're really good. They're a really good interview. And some of them are incredibly funny. And that suddenly made me think, I wonder why more artists don't do this, because I think some words, and this goes back to something you were saying, I think it was on one of last week's shows, about what fans really like is access to their favorite artists or being invited into the artist's world, in which case a podcast is possibly one way of doing that. Do you think?
Exactly, yeah, especially in streaming, where I think the worry a lot of artists have is like, what if I'm just a line on a playlist and people don't know who I am? So yeah, it's a part of the value of podcasts is really, it's not about making loads of money, it's about getting your, if you like you say, inviting people into your world. I think the challenge with artists is like, it's something that's easy to start and more difficult to keep. I mean, that's podcasts generally, I suppose, isn't it? Like so many podcasts start and then run out of steam after 4 or 5 episodes. So is it something you commit to and keep building? Like, as Blossoms have got a pubcast, haven't they? I think that's carried on going for quite a while now, where they get in the pub and just talk. And again, it's about a band in a way is an ideal one, because you've got multiple people who bounce off each other, who know each other well. Like it should be great for if they're funny. But then I've seen quite a few where like, we're launching a podcast for this artist, and then 4 episodes, the album marketing campaign finishes and they never bother again because they're having to record and tour and do all the other things. But yeah, I think, I mean, the other way, of course, is the Jessie Ware route, where you do a podcast that's nothing to do with your music. Like hers is about cookery, isn't it? And eating, but also interviews. And that's become a huge hit. And I think she's done it live, hasn't she? They've taken, what's it called? Dinner, I can't remember the name. Dinner manner, dinner table, table manners, table manners. That's it. So
come dine with Jessie. Come dine with Jessie Ware.
And like, it's really good. It's her and her mum, and they have a guest, and it's brilliant. And it's completely almost separate from what she's doing with her music. It's become a separate, but of course, it's not fans of her music will listen to the podcast, and podcasts will lead people to her music. So, so in a way, as an artist, you could, if you've got another interest, whether it is cookery or gaming or anything, yeah, it's definitely like if an artist has time on their hands, this can be a way. But like we were saying, there's an art to it and a science to it in terms of how many listens you have, how you put ads in, what kind of ads you do. Like, is it an ad that's stuck in the middle, or do you read it out, which is a popular case? But yeah, none of this is taking money away from other musicians. It's a short answer to Fraser's question.
We'll finish with a very complicated question, or at least I found it complicated. I had to read this about four times to make any sense of it. This is from our friend Paul Brindley. I would like to know, brackets genuinely, what explains the discrepancy between two stats from Universal's recent earnings call for 2023? They reported a 9.6% increase in annual recorded music subscription revenues, but also said that revenue from streaming overall only grew by 0.4% year on year. And in Q4, quarter four, the last quarter of the year, Universal Music Group's streaming revenue for recorded music was actually down by 1.3% year on year. Now, I would have thought the percentage of revenue from streaming coming from subscription revenues would be, I mean, much higher than that which comes from other sources such as advertising. That's certainly the case when you look at the major markets such as the US. I guess revenue from streaming overall includes publishing, but that would only explain the discrepancy if publishing was taking a nosedive, which I really don't think is the case. So how could these figures differ to such an extent? When I first read the last line, I did it in a quite a dramatic voice, which was, so how could these figures differ to such an extent? Just to give it a sort of Sherlock Holmes mystery spin. But anyway, what's behind these confusing stats? Can you explain Paul's question to us?
Yeah, this is we should say this is my actual boss, Paul Brindley, and my day job, sending us a hospital pass just to see if I can answer it. But yeah, I mean, in a way, you really need to have Universal Music's financial results in front of you for this, because yeah, what he's saying is right. In their last financials, they said subscription revenue grew 8.9% year over year, streaming revenue declined, and like he says, the reason that's weird is if you think about all streaming revenues, subscription is a huge part of that. It's the biggest part of streaming. So if your subscription revenues go up, the whole of the streaming should go up. Mm. But it's quite a simple answer in the end. It's the way the words that Universal describes. So when they talk about subscription revenue, they mean paid subscriptions to streaming services. And when they use the phrase streaming revenue, they mean everything that's not subscription. So free streaming, so Spotify's
right
here.
So
what happened there was their money from paid subscriptions went up, but their money from free streaming services went down. And that's, and according to the financials, it's about the advertising market. So there, you know, there were fewer ads maybe, or that the advertisers weren't paying as much. So it's really free streaming going down, paid streaming going up, which in a way, this ties into something recently when I went to the IFPI's big launch event, the Global Music Report. And the guy from Sony Music then was saying, yeah, we want some improvements to free streaming. We think we need to change. He actually said we need less free in free streaming. And back then I thought, oh, that's interesting. Like they haven't been talking about not liking free streaming for a decade or more. And this maybe ties into that. So there is a case of the label's money from free streaming is going down. So they're maybe going to start making slightly more menacing noises to people like Spotify saying, how are you going to make more money from free? Or how are you going to switch more of those free listeners to become paying subscribers?
And from that, then I deduce that there are this relationship, I mean, it's a strange relationship, but Spotify and the major labels, are they talking on a virtually weekly basis? Because, I mean, obviously one can't exist without the other. But if the music industry does turn around and say, this is the next thing we want, that creates a whole new ongoing discussion, I suppose, which it does feel like Spotify would try and keep the music industry on side again. So that would be less free and free then.
Yeah. I mean, it's this traditional, it's like a rhythm really. And the deals with labels tend to be 3 years normally, you know, around 3 years, every 3 years they have to renew their licensing deals. And so you do get in the run up to that, you do get more labels in the press saying, actually, next time we sign a deal, we want X, Y, and Z. Like you sort of, it's that kind of rhythm of like, right, the deal's coming up for renewal. Let's start talking about what we want. And yeah, like in a weird way, like back in the early days of Spotify, or maybe a couple of years after it launched, when it was trying to launch in the US, so sort of 2011, 2010, the labels were very, very putting a lot of pressure on it about its free tier then, and saying we want you to restrict the free tier, want to have it, would really shove people towards paying. And so they were kind of cross about the free tier being too good then. And in the years since, the kind of Spotify view has prevailed, that is that the free tier being good is good because people use a service, like it, and then they want to start paying. And the idea is that if you, you know, that it's working well, the system of having free and then paid. So I might wonder if we might have this. I wonder if it might turn back that way of labels saying, actually, we want you to, you know, do something to the free tier, make it less appealing, encourage people to start paying. Because that free tier is more prone to wobbles in advertising, for example, when we've had economic worries.
Right.
So yeah, this could be in the run up to the next round of licensing deal renewals for Spotify and others, you know, other services that have free tiers. It could be, yeah, we're not happy with how the free tier is going. How are you going to change it? And by the way, we have some ideas, and we're going to talk about them.
I love the way you phrase that, and this is possibly true, but if it is, then it paints a rather disappointing picture of how the music industry works. In that, as you say, they would suggest to Spotify to make the free tier less appealing, not make the premium rate more appealing, so that people pay the money for a more appealing, better service. Just make the free one less appealing.
Although, I mean, the other thing that's happening is quite a few things that Spotify has launched recently, including those AI playlists we talked about in the last episode, they're only for paying customers. So in a way, Spotify is starting to say there are certain things you will only get if you pay. And again, that probably has come out of, I mean, there's one motivator for Spotify. Spotify wants people to pay. Like, it's better for its business if they pay. But I think that probably has come out of talking to the labels, and the labels saying, yeah, we want, you know, what are you doing? It's all about, what's the phrase? Conversion rates. Like, what are you doing to up the conversion rate? But I think you're right. I think it's about the carrot, not just the stick.
Yeah.
But it seems like the stick is on labels' minds at the moment, as well as the carrot, I guess.
There you go. Thank you very much, Paul, for your question. In fact, thanks to everyone who's sent us questions. We'll get round to some more very soon. And if you have a question, a query of your own, if there's anything that puzzles you about the finances of the music industry as a fan, or if you're someone who works in the music business who has a query, you can get hold of us at the usual address, Stuart.
It's theprice of music podcast@gmail.com.
You do that so well. Thank you very much for listening. Do subscribe to the podcast in your podcast app and give us a rating if you have a second. We'll be back with more next week. Till then, take care, everybody. Say goodbye, Stuart.
Goodbye, Stuart.